Interesting Times podcast is back for season 2. And today I'm speaking with Sanjeev Kumar, head of European Geothermal Energy Council. We'll talk about Ukraine and EU energy policy. Sanjeev, it's nice to see you today.
It's a pleasure to see you, Elena. How are you?
Good, and you?
Wonderful, thank you. And given current circumstances.
Yeah. So Sanjeev, tell me please, with the current conflict in Ukraine, what is EU doing in terms of its energy policy?
Okay. Before we go into the energy policy, it's important to understand the relationship between Europe and Russia. Russia and many other countries has been one of trade dependence and interdependence. So Russia has many minerals and resources, which Europe and many other countries around the world are in need of. So there's always been a trading relationship between the two. With the crisis in Ukraine, that relationship has been strained, and that's partly a misunderstanding on the European side and partly something by design on the Russian side. So the misunderstanding on European from European perspective has been that they've never really fully understood the foreign policy elements of energy. They've kind of assumed this is a commodity and it's a trading relationship. And the history of energy policy has told us that energy is not about trading. It's a power play. You know, in the olden days, we used to call energy fuel policy. Before that, we used to call it foreign policy or power policy. It's, you know, so you have to understand the context of what we're talking about before we can kind of deep dive into the situation that we are at the moment. It's also worthwhile saying that, you know, the situation we're in today has been burning for a long, long time. Europe first introduced its climate and energy package way back in 2007. We had a financial crisis. Then straight after the financial crisis, we had the very first crisis in the Crimea. And that led to a set of revisions to our climate and energy legislation, particular focus around infrastructure. Now, at the time, many observers said that the focus on kind of fossil infrastructure was a concern. We have a climate, you know, we have a climate crisis, and instead of actually looking at ways to kind of accelerate investments into renewables, into energy savings, kind of de-risking energy consumption, what we did was kind of increase our dependence on a couple of fuels, and that's in the short term it made financial sense because it went cheap fossil energy, but of course in the medium to long term it just meant that the climate crisis is going to cost a lot more, and then actually Europe then exposes itself to some pretty serious geopolitical risks, which we see to be being borne out today. So it's I think the key thing for us to understand now is that it's not so much how we manage the crisis but actually how we manage the post-crisis period as well, because if we leave the situation that we're in at the moment with the same mindset and this, you know, and let's just go back to the past and assume that's a good thing, then we would have absolutely missed the opportunity. The Chinese have this fantastic saying that, you know, every crisis is an opportunity. This is opportunities are ringing. And if we don't seize the moment and actually don't reposition and pivot our energy systems and our economies into clean technology, into you know, low risk, very sustainable economic system models, then we're going to become susceptible to much bigger crises, whether it's another military conflict, whether it's a military conflict driven by resource scrambles or by climate impacts, which then have a resource scramble. Either which way, the future doesn't look pretty. And if the future is business as usual, then it's going to be much worse than we are today.
Sanjeev, so what is EU doing currently right now?
At the moment, the EU has two pieces that it's following. The first one is the kind of Fit for 55% greenhouse gas emission reduction. That's a huge legislative package that it has on the way to kind of, you know, fast track renewable energy, energy efficiency, focus on kind of renewable heating for the very first time, which is actually quite interesting. And then there's kind of other issues such as, you know, effectively a business as usual for the way the gas market operates, and you know, some kind of some language around energy efficiency in buildings. It sounds okay, but actually in terms of hard substance, it's not quite there. But anyway, that's aside. That was pre-crisis. And actually pre-crisis, the narrative was all about kind of, you know, energy independence, about much more sustainability, all the kind of things that would help shield us from the crisis that's emerged from February this year. From February this year, the immediate response has been the Repower EU plan. And, you know, whilst it's very, very, you know, it's very, very impressive that, you know, the slow-moving EU, which is normally very complex and, you know, full of kind of political rivalry, has moved very quickly. It's moved very, very quickly. So that's reassuring. What's slightly less reassuring is that whilst all the narratives are there, it's kind of leading us into situations that are perhaps not the most optimal paths to take. This is, you know, you can understand that when you're rushed through a decision, but, you know, some of this is... yeah, there are some issues with this one, but the Repower plan has kind of got, surprisingly, the very first focus is diversifying energy sources. Now, in a you can understand how you would come to that rationally as a decision. You know, hey, okay, we have to diversify the supplies that we get from Russia, from other countries. Problem with that is that that's a high cost pathway. It's absolutely not sustainable. So it's a real short term, let's throw all the money we possibly have at the problem. To put that in context, when, you know, during the Second World War, when we had the same kind of energy related issues, the principal focus was on energy efficiency. You can go to any museum and there'll be posters of, you know, turn off your lights, don't use your heating, use as less as you possibly can to survive. There's been none of that messaging coming out from the EU. It's all kind of, let's just carry on, but we're just going to buy our, you know, energy resources from somewhere else. That's quite a worrying focus. The second element has been to kind of push for more and more hydrogen. Hydrogen has, you know, a role to play. How big that role, however, is questionable. But certainly that's the second thing that I kind of prioritise. Let's just do more and more hydrogen. It's important that hydrogen is renewable rather than fossil, because if it's still fossil, then we're still back in the climate crisis and we're going to rely on even more fossil consumption from elsewhere. So, you know, the cost, you know, in the olden days, you used to have like cost benefit analysis and you had to go for the most cost effective solution. That's all gone now. That world is dead. And it's important now that we carry that mindset into when we do the cost benefit analysis for the clean technologies that we want to have on the ground. Somewhere there is a focus on renewables as like a third pillar. There's a focus on things like energy efficiency, but that's kind of way down the pecking line. So the stuff that we need to do first is right down the bottom. But that's the kind of general response from the EU. Now we're waiting for sometime around May when we're going to get a bit more concrete ideas on what needs to happen. You know, what needs to happen for the transport sector, what needs to happen for the industrial sectors who face a particular type of risk. We can come onto that later. For buildings, for example, whenever we have an energy crisis in wintertime, that's normally always a heat crisis, because that's when you consume heat. It's the peak demand because it's cold. And what we've always done is we've used words to describe it that don't use the word heat, and therefore the solutions and the thinking is never close to what it needs to be. If you in cold times, if you need energy, you need warmth, and therefore, you know, building insulation, renewable heating, these are the kind of things you need to be prioritizing. Power isn't, you know, power generation isn't the answer to these very specific problems. Heat pumps are. Renewable heating, ambient heating, ground source, geothermal, solar thermal. These are the kind of spaces where you need to be focused in on. But that's all of that is lost. In fact, I think from the Repower Europe communication, there's no mention of heat at all in the whole, even though, you know, the preceding winter period up until the invasion was all about high heating bills. But that seems to have been lost in the, unfortunately, that seems to be lost. So that's the kind of the track the Commission has gone down, the track we as Europe have gone down. I think it's worthwhile exploring just how sustainable these options are, or, you know, in kind of, you know, boring academic parlance, what's the policy, what's the risk of failure, you know, policy failure. And I think, you know, the first one is very clearly, if you look at LNG, LNG is a very tight market globally, as we mentioned, prices are high, there's a potential that prices will go higher. There's also a potential that some of the Asian countries, which are consuming a lot of the LNG, effectively just sell their LNG at much higher prices and go back to coal. So we jump out of one frying pan and into a bigger frying pan with the climate crisis. That's one potential thing. Let's wait and see how that goes.
Can you clarify the difference between the traditional gas supply and LNG, please?
Yes, of course. The difference between LNG and pipeline gas is effectively one of efficiency and cost. So when it comes to pipeline gas is generally considerably cheaper than LNG. LNG stands for liquefied natural gas. So you build a pipeline, all the costs are pretty much in the pipeline. You then have a sunk asset, and it's just a case of getting the fuel pushed through the pipeline. That's really, really all it is. It's always been the cheapest form of energy. This is why there's a desire to build pipelines into Europe, because you want cheap gas. LNG you first have to take the energy, you then have to liquefy it, then you have to transport it, then you have to regasify it, you have to store it, and then push it back into the system. So there's so many steps you've got to go through. That means you've got efficiency hurdles all the way, or penalties all the way. And of course, you've got costs. You've got the cost of shipping compared to a pipeline is significantly different. The cost of storage, the cost of transforming the gas is way more complex than simply pushing it through a pipeline. So that's really, really quite important. LNG is high cost. LNG is is much more rarer. And sadly, a lot of the LNG that we see coming from the US comes from fracking. So it's, you know, there's a significant climate penalty that's coming with this as well. This is, you know, you're literally burning the tap in order to burn another tap.
Clarify. So the LNG from the US that Europe is switching to is more costly and worse for the environment than the traditional gas that the EU has been purchasing from Russia.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. That's exactly it. You know, the last thing we want is for the US to start investing more in unconventional gas in order to meet Europe's needs. That's just... Mm-hmm. So nobody wins. It really, really is zero-sum thinking there. The second thing is the focus on hydrogen. Hydrogen is important. It's a significant role to play. The concern is that it shouldn't be that high a priority compared to energy efficiency. I mean, now more than ever, we should be talking about reducing our energy consumption. I mean, if you go to any museum today, you pick up any history book, you can go back and look at how governments communicated to one another, to their citizens during the Second World War, even in the First World War. Really basic things: rationing. You know, don't cut out all the stuff that you don't need to do, because that resource is just very, very costly. All the energy efficiency programs that you see today are pretty much modelled during the Second World War. I mean, I can remember in London when I was in the Energy Institute, you know, all these posters from like 1941, 1942 about, you know, turn off your radiators, don't turn the lights on unless you desperately need them. You know, we haven't had any announcement about turning your TV off, making sure that if you have something with a standby to unplug, so you don't have the red light on all night long. These are really basic things to be doing. You just need a clear instruction, and we really haven't had them. I mean, it's like late into the day when governments have started talking about turning down your thermostat. I mean, we're kind of... Winter is pretty much going away now. The horse is already bolted, and that's just kind of symptomatic of how we're trying to still think of this in our supply term mindsets, rather than let's do the best thing we possibly can. Let's all pull together. If we pull together a kind of energy efficiency mindset, would have created a much stronger bonds between us as citizens, as people, and it would have just meant that we're all in this together, and that we, you know, we're doing everything we can to just stop us making decisions which are suboptimal. And the focus on LNG The focus on building new LNG terminals is also, again, a really, sounds great on paper, feels like you're actually doing something, but it takes, you know, I think 3 to 5 years to build an LNG terminal. Most of the LNG terminal capacity in Europe has never been full. And it's, you know, it's a small fraction of the actual overall demand. So reduce demand, that's the first thing you would expect a rational government to make. Now, okay, we can understand these are rushed decisions, but still, somebody should have said, guys, you've stopped doing stuff. It's the best thing you could possibly do.
So what do you should be doing?
What's interesting is the comments from Torben Brabo, the president of Gas Infrastructure Europe. This is the trade association for the infrastructure, the gas and industry infrastructure sector. And he says that the kind of reductions that are forecast from biomethane are quote unquote probably optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that, you know, a significant chunk of emission reduction or a diversification is unlikely to happen. And that just highlights again the risk of kind of picking solutions that are not really genuine solutions. These are high risk. And what we really need to be doing is prioritizing the easy things to do. This is why energy efficiency and, you know, renewable power, but also renewable heat are the prime things to do. Because it doesn't matter, you know, whatever happens, those are still the best investments to make.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, things like biomethane, you know, some of the green gases, even hydrogen, they have very specific but unique and, you know, questionable in terms of how much of a contribution they're going to make to overall emission reduction. So whilst they're getting all the kind of narrative and all the gravity, the political impetus, they're not the things you would expect to see prioritised. You know, we've got a window of about 6 months before autumn and winter start to come around, when our reliance and dependence on the Russian imports is going to massively increase. The same has been massively increasing for the last decade or so. So what we should be doing now is using this window to fast track as quickly as possible anything that cuts down heating demand in a couple of sectors,
mm-hmm.
In buildings and in industry. It's worthwhile saying that in industry, the concerns are much different to buildings. For example, buildings is where we live. That's the kind of social fabric of our existence. Industry is kind of where we work, and we're, you know, our contributions to the GDP are really made. Now, supply contracts for industry tend to be different to ones for householders. So for households, you really don't build in provision that we're just going to cut off your energy supply. You can do that, but I think the response will be, you know, very swift from a lot of people. For industry, they build these into their contracts. So, you know, you can have a supply disruption, you get, you know, compensation, et cetera, et cetera. It's really well thought of. Now, the problem there is that how would you switch off industry for? I mean, if you say, okay, guys, let's take, for example, the chemical sector, which needs a lot of gas for its feedstock. Okay, for, you know, from October to February next year, from the back end of this year to next year, you close down, full stop. That's going to be significant. It's going to have a significant impact, not just in the chemical sector, but across the economy. So it's these are big, big issues. The smart thing to be doing is to say, okay, let's rethink let's think about the best ways in which we can get investments directly into reducing demand in buildings, because that's the biggest consumer of fossils, biggest consumer of the Russian energy imports, and transport as well. Those are the two big areas. They're also the bits that most people are interested in their daily life. I mean, we all have a house, we all have an apartment, we all have a fossil boiler in our apartment. Okay, it's the only time we own the fossil capacity, or we can see it every single day. And the other time is transport. We all have to walk somewhere, whether you're going to, you know, walk, taking your kids to school, or you're going to the supermarket. It's, you know, you can't avoid cars which have tailpipe emissions, you know, internal combustion engines. So we've got to, you know, those are two kind of areas we need to fast track your activities. Now for transport, it's not necessarily time dependent. You know, the transport system that you have today it doesn't, in winter, you're not going to drive more. Okay. So you've got a bit more time to play. But what you do have is a slightly longer lead in time. Because if you're going to build buses and you're going to go for more kind of electric public transport, you need to make those orders today. Mm-hmm. So part of what we could be doing is just finding ways in which you can do bulk purchases of clean technology like electric buses. I mean, we did this with vaccines. It was very successful. As an example, just within recent memory, where Europe coming together, making bulk purchases, was economically efficient, was just the right thing to do, and just made sure that the only issue we really face is at a local level is the distribution. How do we get it? How quickly do we roll it out? That's what we should be doing. That would be a straightforward action which would have an immediate impact on our fuel consumption in transport.
Yeah.
For buildings, we need to kind of move away from putting all the pressure on individual households. We've got a multitude of other things to think about. With kind of subsidy schemes and so on and so forth, those work for kind of very wealthy elites. They don't work for everybody. If you're going to, for example, get a rebate on your taxes, yeah, okay, you've got to fill in the rebate tax forms. You've got to have enough kind of financial capital to then wait for that to come back to you at the end of the year, the end of the fiscal year. If you have a subsidy, we have a situation where we have a lot of people in fuel poverty. That's increased as energy prices have increased. If you then say, okay, well, you're a household and you're making a choice between, do I turn my heating on or do I eat food? really basic choices like that. Giving them a 30% or even a 40% discount on the cost of home insulation or the windows or their heating system is just ridiculous, because the answer is going to be they're going to do nothing. They're going to try and survive. So in those kind of areas, what we need to do is just to change the decision-making responsibility, not from the individual homeowner, from the tenant in a building, but just effectively say, okay, there are institutional infrastructure agencies across Europe. You just have to go and build it up. That's your responsibility. Mm-hmm. We'll find a way to pay you. Or what you do is like we do with our fossil system at the moment, or our energy system at the moment, you put the burden on the building, not on the individual. So if you walk into a new house, all the investment in infrastructure has already been made, and you just a percentage of your energy bill has infrastructure costs already attached into it. So if we just classify energy efficiency and renewables, especially renewable heating, as infrastructure, then you pay over the lifetime of the building. So it's not the individual who's making a choice, it's the, in some cases, the distribution system operator, the energy regulator. They make the choice, and all we do is just sit down and wait for them to fix the problem for us. So it's a question of hurry up, rather than I have to decide what to do, what's economically efficient, what my payback rate is. We don't push this to the individual level. You want to fix it, you fix it further up the value chain, and you move much quicker. And that's one of the things that that's the most disappointing thing of the thinking that we have at the moment, is this continued reliance on individuals and homeowners making rational choices. They don't make rational choices in the first place. This is partly why we have a climate crisis. But actually, the reason we have a climate crisis is that we push the pressure onto individuals to make decisions, rather than go upstream where you can have a much bigger impact and much quicker impact. So somewhere along the line, we've got to rethink our business models, and that's the thing that's missing from the Repower Europe plan at the moment, and all of the dialogue that's gone around with it. Everyone's kind of stuck in a narrow tunnel vision of, well, give us a target. And now at the moment, there's this talk of front loading. So when it comes to renewables, photovoltaics, wind, ambient heat pumps, geothermal heat pumps, solar thermal, let's just do them all really quickly. Which sounds really, really good. Let's front load. It's took me a while to understand what the word front loading means, but realistically speaking, that's just meaning you massively inflate the cost, the resource scarcity right at the start. And that's really not a sustainable thing to be doing. Mm-hmm. The much more straightforward thing would be to do and say, well, look, okay, we've got two pieces of regulation on the table at the moment. We have a gas market and a directive and regulation. Within that, you have responsibilities for DSOs, distribution system operators. Give them a clear mandate to build very explicitly district heating systems linked to geothermal, to solar thermal, to kind of other renewable sources, If you cannot do those, then look at individual help, you know, individual solutions or community solutions, but just do everything in one go. But you become responsible for the transition.
Mm-hmm.
And then you actually give these guys a way out, because at the moment they are locked into, we have to do fossils and we can only do fossils. And that's, you know, that just means that you don't streamline, you don't give them a new business model to move into. They're stuck in that space. And that's, you know, that's a real tragedy. It's open goal and we are just missing that goal. The second thing is to say, well, look, you know, wherever possible, if the DSOs cannot make those kind of political directional changes, local authorities try to do this every single day. Now, what we should be doing is to say, okay, we're going to make money available for heat mapping. So you're looking at all the local resources and you can start to zone in where we're going to have this big infrastructure, where we're going to have, you know, X infrastructure and Y infrastructure, and just kind of, you know, planning up. A lot of regions are doing this already.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be very big regions. They tend to be very wealthy. So, you know, or in wealthy parts of Europe. So take Belgium, all across Belgium, you've got lots of local authorities. Charleroi is kind of rezoning its energy system. Antwerp is doing that. Brussels is now slowly starting to think through this as well at the moment. You know, things are moving. Munich is moving. Munich is one of the richest cities in the world, I think. Berlin, Frankfurt, these are wealthy, wealthy places.
Mm-hmm.
It gets much harder when you start getting to the slightly smaller cities and also to the less wealthy countries, because there you need to have support. You know, there you have to have an understanding of what the actual system capabilities are and what's the right direction to go in.
Yeah.
You can't just say it's going to be low carbon or renewable. You've got to be much more explicit. So there you need to have a degree of capacity support, and that's really, really missing from the Commission's thinking, but actually from the general discourse around the Commission's thinking. It's really very, very poor. Again, it's the old mindset, it's the pre-war mindset of like, okay, we're going to get over this and then we're going to go back to the world where nothing's really changed. And then we'll have the climate crisis and then we'll be like, okay, what do we do now? Oh, we should have done this ages ago. I think we need to get it right this time, because the gap between now, you know, whilst all this crisis has been going on, Antonio Guterres from the UN,
mm-hmm.
very, very clear, the window to actually get out of the climate crisis is now starting to close. You know, the impacts that we're seeing are, it's not alarmism now. I mean, it's you're physically, things are different. Things are, the energy and the climatic system is in a space which is very, very uncomfortable. I mean, in India, over the last couple of days, you've had temperatures, I mean, you've had, you know, temperatures where it's hard to live. That's the norm. Now, you know, everyone's, at the moment in Europe, it's okay, you don't have that. It's only a matter of time before that becomes a norm there. Now, by the time that becomes a norm in Europe, in places like in the South, in the global South, it's life is going to be uninhabitable. And that's a whole new geopolitical risk that kind of comes on the radar. So we really don't have the luxury of making mistakes. As I mentioned before, that Chinese saying is really, really important. You've got to see the opportunity. And at the moment, the opportunity is we're going to sell a bit more kit, not we're going to solve a problem. And that's a political failure. And it doesn't matter. There's no one else to blame other than the people in charge at the moment and those advising them at the moment. That's the travesty we're in. So yes. Things are moving. Whether they're moving in the right direction, whether they're going to get there quickly enough is another story. But the world we're in at the moment isn't a pretty place to be.
And with the current energy policy, how independent can the EU be?
Okay, that's a really, really good question. I mean, the first one is that it needs to have a degree of much more self-sufficiency. That's normal. It certainly needs to be much more independent of fossil fuels, irrespective of whatever conflict there is in the world. We have a bigger conflict against the climate that we need to be addressing. I think there's a much more profound response, which is what does interdependence really look like? Because ultimately, we all live on the same planet. We all have to share one another's successes and also one another's trials and tribulations. This is just life. you know, it's interesting you talk about, or it's interesting the kind of conversation that happens with independence. You can't physically move Belgium into Hawaii, for example. You can't just say, okay, we're completely relocating, we're going to become an independent part of the Atlantic Ocean or something like that. It just doesn't work. What we need to do is just to go back and find new ways in which we can have mutual interdependence that's genuinely positive for our ecosystem and our common way of living. That's the space we need to move into. And that kind of means that we need to redo the historical way in which we've interacted with our countries, that kind of, you know, that you know, conflict, that you know, exploitation type model. This is about cooperation. It's a different system, but it's a system that kind of works. It works. People are cooperative. You know, we have mutual interests, and we need to kind of bring those ones together. So part of this means that, you know, we need to start thinking again about our treaties and alliances around, for example, phasing out fossil fuels. You know, we have a big discussion around, you know, coal and kind of coal exit, but there's a lot of, you know, knowledge and experience that we've shared across the world. And, mm-hmm. you know, if we were to have a global push, then that can kind of help move out coal. But moving out coal isn't the answer, because we've got to move out of gas. So, for example, pre-crisis, Frans Timmermans, the executive vice president of the commission, was saying that, you know, for some countries, you have to transition from coal to gas in order to get to renewables. Now, we knew at the time that was a very suspect thing to do because the cost and the time and the, you know, the political economy that's associated with that are very entrenched, so you're kind of going to be stuck. But, you know, we have huge opportunities. We have huge opportunities to talk about kind of common technologies. The, you know, electric transport, for example, just we should be having trade deals around electric and transport, around kind of clean heating systems. Our knowledge and experience, you know, what Europe has a huge amount of knowledge and experience around district heating. There are other countries around the world that are starting to look towards district heating systems. Beijing, for example, has a really ambitious program to convert to geothermal district heating, mm-hmm. Low temperature. This is fantastic technology. All the expertise that's there is coming from Europeans, mm-hmm. who have familiarity within Europe and are kind of exporting that one. The US is now looking very much so at renewable district heating through geothermal. Again, let's bring these different things together and work out how we can create positive relationships. It's, you know, in some cases it may be sharing expertise, know-how, in some cases it may be technologies, but that's a much more healthy relationship than just buying and consuming fossil commodities. Mm-hmm. Because they are inherently destructive. What we need to be doing is to repackage our economy. I think there's also another opportunity for us to, you know, ultimately repackage the way in which we do economic analysis. You know, part of the problem is that we, you know, we're stuck in these kind of static equilibrium business models and forecasting systems, which means that we don't take into account kind of planetary boundaries. This is all the work that the donut economics, yeah. Is about. You know, we have a very narrow space in which we need to operate in. So, but the numbers and how we value success is part of our problem. You know, we reward people who, for example, chop down a forest because you produce commodities from the trees that have been chopped down. But, you know, the value of that ecosystem is much more valuable than a chair or a table. No matter how good the table and chair are and how comfortable they are, it's much more valuable. So we've got to find a way to repurpose our economics there. That's a really good way to start talking about cooperation rather than conflict. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we started off talking about opportunities. The kind of things I would love us to be in during and after the crisis we're in at the moment is, you know, a genuine realignment of the way in which we do economics, a genuine focus on, you know, clean, green technologies. These are not clever ideas. These are pretty obvious things to be doing, but we're just not doing them. Maybe this is the opportunity for us to do that. And I think at the same time, hopefully it will mean that we don't have that kind of blinkered view about what the clean future really looks like. Because at the moment, all of our thinking is dominated by, wind turbines, photovoltaics, electric vehicles. the energy system we're going to need is going to be a lot more complex. You know, we're going to have a lot more thinking and investment in things like concentrated solar power. That radically changes a lot of the way in which we get to 100% renewable power systems. Ocean energy, completely, hardly ever spoken about, but really the wealth in the potential energy that can be trapped from that in a sustainable way is very, very big. Let's work through how do we get more and more of a contribution there. But actually, what we need to do is just to start looking at global and national and regional pure renewable energy systems. What levels of efficiency need to be factored in there? What does efficiency really look like? Is it just burning fossils in a more efficient way, or is it just completely designing out any form of fossil? Then you've got all sorts of things like how do we advance the understanding and technological development of things like a bio, sustainable F-gases, for example. F-gases are really, really important for a lot of kind of clean heating solutions, for example. These are the kind of things we need to get the scientific community, the engineering community to collaborate on. So I prefer us to do things where we're kind of building pyramids of the future rather than knocking down the pyramids that we have at the moment. That's, you don't have to be, an anti-war protester to say things like this. This is pretty much common sense. You don't have economic stability in a crisis, so avoid crises as much as possible. And actually, life becomes much more economically fun, much more financially beneficial, and actually just nicer if we did things which are mutually beneficial rather than mutually destructive. It's a simple thing, but it's about talking about independence. It's about having the honesty and the maturity to talk about what does our new relationship look like, not how much of the past do we keep, because the past is not prologue.
Thank you. Sanjeev, it was really insightful.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure as always. Thank you.
These were Elena Dons and Sanjeev Kumar and The Interesting Times. Thank you and see you next time.
Thank you.